Rex this hour pertaining to the strange death of Loretta Fuddy, the Obama birth certificate gatekeeper. And Rex has put together some incredible investigative findings, the product of countless years of research. And we're going through these now, folks. If you are listening only on archive or on audio only, go to our YouTube channel and find the shows that we have done with Rex. There are two parts, and you can see all the visual images there to go along with what you're hearing on the radio. With that, let's get right back to Rex and what we were talking about just before the break.
Okay, thank you. We were looking at a slide called the bag, and that bag seems to change shape. It starts out floating very high atop the water as if it's not heavy, and it changes shape in every frame subsequent to that. So we're looking from the upper left to the upper right to the lower left and the lower right, and we see there's a constant change in the shape of this bag, which might be some kind of passenger baggage, it would appear, but we learn that it's really not that at all. The lower left image with that elderly gentleman who appears to have very has blonde hair, he has his right hand on what has become the shape of the bag. In his left hand, he's holding at his chest another PFD still in its container. But as we go to the next slide, we'll see subsequent images on that left column, leftmost column, one very much like the, or just one ahead, that is with the elderly gentleman's holding the bag at that point and his left hand holding the PFD. Then all of those pictures, the four pictures below, are subsequent frames where the bag is continually changing shape and we see different portions of it above water. Now, in the right image, we have that same Army Green Beret guy, and the elderly gentleman with the blonde hair was a book author. But in his book, he claims that the image of the Army Green Beret guy was actually the book author. And we know that wasn't the case, but he claims that was the book author, and he was bringing his wife, who is along the wing, that next female person there, just to the left of the guy sitting on the wing. And he said he was bringing her life jacket. Well, we watched the video, and we see that that was neither that elderly gentleman, but the Green Beret guy swims away from the wing and doesn't have an extra personal flotation device and doesn't give anything to that lady along the wing. So perhaps that was just an innocent mistake. However, there's a lot to be said beyond that that's more than just coincidence. If we move to image 75, we see, firstly, the same column on the left, but the next column over to the right shows at the top this elderly gentleman's wife literally strapping on something, and that is the bag as it's changed shape and taken on a very unique visual aspect. That is, it would appear that it has an 18-inch phallus on it, and that's quite something to pull out of a bag. And we see those top two pictures. After she's strapped it on, she's taken kind of a sitting position in the water, and that phallus shape is held above the water. In the two lowest pictures we see, that's sitting above the water as she's moving along for the next almost probably 35, 40 minutes, something like that. Now, when one has a shape like that and one is holding it above the water, electronics people say, ooh, maybe that's an antenna. Could be. Communications antenna held above the water line. Well, that's a very good chance, frankly. And certainly, it also doubles as her personal flotation device. It's keeping her up in the water. So that appears to be what the purpose of that bag was. Communications and the PFD for this lady who otherwise didn't have it. So we see on the pictures on the right, particularly in the third row, the top two, and the one at the far right that's very tall vertically, that this bag is with this elderly lady, the wife of the other elderly gentleman, stays with her for most of the scenario. But those two lower horizontal images in the third row marked NTSB 749 and 827, we see the so-called changeover event that we talked about in the first segment. That is, at the very same time that Fuddy is replaced by a military-trained diver with a red wig and is over 6 foot tall and appears to be something in the 160 to 170-pound range, at the very moment that happens, this lady, the elderly lady, gives up her special personal flotation device. And now she's been given perhaps the very same personal flotation device that her husband was carrying on his chest for her. So that would appear to be the case. And it does show in all this sequence that that would have had to been done with foreknowledge. So that's not the only aspect of foreknowledge, but it's, as we say, yet another aspect of foreknowledge. If we move on, which we can do, to image 78.
All right. That would be...
It says whoopsie on the left.
There it is.
We hear from the people who spoke to the Maui County Police. They said they left the plane when it began to sink. And elsewhere they've said that was 25 minutes. The NTSB report uses that number as well. That is, 25 minutes after the ditching, there was apparently represented to be a ditching or a sinking event of the airplane. And the upper left picture is just before, the last image, one of the last frames we have, before they left the airplane. Now, if we look to the image on at right, we see an image taken by the first on the scene helicopter pilot. He wasn't flying his helicopter that day, but he had on-scene experience with Hawaii 5-0 and lost television programs. But anyway, in his lens at that moment, or that of his girlfriend, he's showing the airplane after the people have left. And if you look very closely at the characteristics of what's above the water and what isn't, it's almost identical. That is, there is no sinking event evident at all. So it's very curious that all the passengers that spoke to the police said that there was a sinking event, and that's why they left the airplane. And in fact, not only did they leave the airplane at that time, but they supposedly became separated from one another. So that's very unusual.
Okay, I have a question, though. How do you account for the difference in water? It looks like almost like turbulence around the body of the aircraft. What's that about? What is that about?
I can't say. It's curious, frankly. There's no wave action that would seem to justify that. One might be tempted to think that there's some photoshopping going on there, but I don't really have enough
to say. It just looks out of place. Yeah, it just looks...
It perhaps does look out of place, especially so violently, if you will, off the left side. Well, maybe the right side is different, but as we noted earlier, it seemed... At least earlier, the left wing was out of the water, so maybe that's part of it. It may be very innocent, and frankly, I don't think it matters at this point because there's just so much evidence of other things that we don't depend anything on that.
Okay.
But in any event, if we look at the lower image and move to the next slide, 79, it borrows the same image below. We see something alongside the aircraft. And I've called it a green slip and slide. And I'm not here able to tell you exactly what it is, but my conjecture is that it might be some transportation for these divers we've seen evidence of.
Yeah, that looks
and
like a raft.
Especially, pardon?
It almost looks like a raft. Raft, yeah.
Yeah, and we see some darker figures there that we don't see elsewhere. And actually, within seconds, we'll say within 10 seconds, certainly, at least as we have imagery for, the little slip and slide disappears. And that's quite unusual. But one thing I didn't mention from the previous slide, you know, the level of the door in the water and both the images when passengers were around it and then apparently away, it was very low in the water. But this lower image, after the passengers have left, and we have every reason to believe it was another 25 or 30 minutes later, the aircraft is somehow higher in the water. The wings are still at the top of the water, but the cabin of the aircraft is raised, and raised 4 or 5, maybe even 6 feet out of the water compared to where it was. And that's not just conjecture. It's seen in the upper three images there in sequence, which all happened, we'll say, within 30 seconds of one another. Somehow, maybe all by itself, that aircraft is coming up out of the water. Do you see the sequence and that open doorway, for example? It's being raised out of the water. How could that possibly happen? Please, someone tell me. Well, how about those arrows? What are those arrows pointing at? In left and right images, there appear to be a lot of bubbles or a spray of bubbles kind of coming up. But in the middle one, the one with the red arrow, there is what you just have to call a man-made device. And it wasn't some dinghy that somehow perchance crashed into the nose of that airplane. That's just beyond the realm. And we don't see it that way at all. That is, there's not an approach of some half-sunken dinghy that comes toward the airplane. No, not at all. It rises out of the water from that very point and goes right back down. I tell you, the evidence suggests all of that is man-made, and it suggests that there were people at this aircraft doing all of these things.
Interesting.
And fortunately, it's not going to be left to a lot of conjecture, because we have a very good idea what these people were doing. But it's amazing that there are people with serious injuries out there on the water, and none of them is being brought to shore by people we know are there. That is, I'm going to say, those people were not given orders to see to the needs, potentially, of these other plane occupants. They were letting them suffer with, in some cases, very serious injuries. That tells us the kind of planning that the people who set up this hoax were capable of, frankly. There were clearly people here doing these things, raising that airplane out of the water, and perhaps using that slip and slide for transport. We see some dark figures there. I'm not sure what they are, but this is clearly human evidence. There's just no escaping it, and it's confirmed by many other things. I'm not just saying it on the basis of these images, but in the middle right picture there as well is also this bubbly spew, and it appears to be just above the cabin or at the tail end of the engine where the engine and fuselage meet, which is called the firewall. And there's a lot of support for what that might be. And we saw earlier the unfolding equipment on the wing. And I think we're going to see and probably be left with the best conjecture we could make on basis of very solid evidence that the engine is being cut off that airplane, which is an astounding thing to say. But astounding, outrageous, audacious, all of those things fit this scenario. And I don't say that on the basis of wild-eyed conjecture. We've got a whole lot more evidence that we're going to look at.
Okay. And you've got a whole lot of free reign tonight, because I do want to get to the bottom of this. So, you want to take, okay, which is the next, should we, okay.
Let's go to 87, image 87.
Okay.
And this is an image taken from, again, the airplane, the first on the scene aircraft. This Hollywood connected kind of guy who's done helicopter scenes for Hawaii Five-0. And it shows, indeed, 260 yards from shore. And that airplane, in the slight left distance there, shortly past the rocks, is the approach end of runway 5. You can almost see a 5 on it. And this is a very calm day. It's a nice warm day, almost 80 degrees. And since the pilot said he didn't want his passengers to hold on to the airplane, it's only reasonable that they consider going to shore, because there would be nothing to hold on to anyway in the pilot's ideas. But we've looked very closely at how long it would take a person to swim, and the long and the short is even a beginner without a life jacket should be able to swim that distance in 7 minutes or less. And instead, all of those passengers, including the pilot, were out on that water waiting for helicopter rescue an average of 100 minutes. Who would make a choice or choices like that? It's mind-boggling.
Definitely not 300
operating. To the next slide, 88. That's the same picture. And we see, what in the world? What is that off to the right? It appears to be something like a conning tower sticking out of the water, and it seems to be leaving a wake. And not only that, beyond that, to the far right, is something that could well be a propulsion wake. And we know that there are swimmer delivery vehicles that would fit that very description. In fact, fit that image. That is, those two lower images are depictions. One's a picture, one's a drawing, but of that very swimmer delivery vehicle. And you'll see that the conning tower type thing and the periscope and another, some other kind of conning tower, some other kind of scope is raised up there in the lower right picture. Apparently each of those is individually extensible. So that would account for exactly the image we have. So we don't have confirmation of that just yet, but it is something to keep in mind. If we look at...
Let me ask you this, though. The depth of the water there, would that be... Wouldn't that prohibit a vehicle, a delivery vehicle such as this, to navigate in that area?
Well, that's a very, very salient and appropriate question. If we look at the bathymetry there, that exact area is about as far as it could go, just in that area, and the rest of it is even more shallow. The draft there is about 8 feet, so there would be area there that it could slightly maneuver, but that would be about or near the end of it in terms of any closer to shore, and it would have not been able to do that.
Gotcha.
So it's... that's a good place for it to be. Not much closer to shore would be what I'd say. But if we, we've made FOIA requests, and the Navy responded to that request and said there were no PAC fleet ships in that area, and no ships were involved with any rescue of the people out there on the water. Well, we didn't ask about any ships that were involved with the rescue. So the Navy, in its response, FOIA response, used what I would call weasel words to get out of the direct question that we had posed. And that was in May of 2015. But about 10 months later, and we can move to the next slide, we got two more FOIA responses. And it seems the Navy changed its tune. We had made a slight wording adjustment in our request, so they were no longer able to use any weasel words. And we elicited two different responses from different branches of the Navy. And it turns out that there were Navy ships in the area, two destroyers up there atop the USS Halsey and the USS O'Kane, both of which were able to land a helicopter. And we know that there was a Navy helicopter on scene in this very incident. So it's conceivable, though not confirmed by anything that we've seen in writing, that such a helicopter could have ferried a Fuddy who was extracted from the scene to one or the other of those ships. So that's part of the answer. And the other is on the right. That FOIA response said, and it's expanded there at the lower part, the white portion at the bottom of the frame, says, ultimately, one record was found potentially responsive to your request, but some portions were classified. But they do tell us that the La Jolla, a submarine that just happens coincidentally to be outfitted to be able to deal with and carry swimmer delivery vehicles, was assigned to that very area that very day. And up until then, it had not been assigned to that area. That very USS La Jolla is shown on the right with a dry deck shelter and SDV, right, as it is above the label USS La Jolla in green, with different generations, if you will, of various SEAL delivery or swimmer delivery vehicles. Another SDV is shown there at the lower right, and that was of the very same type that we showed earlier. So, what was it, 27 months after this crash, we got confirmation that a craft that could very well have carried exactly what we saw on the water to this very site, they had orders to do so. That is, and to not, be in that area.
Yeah, not in that area before, right? No, this is that, on that,
no,
very
that
day.
Very day, indeed, only within hours of that time. But everything other than the name of the craft has been deemed classified. Now, you'd have to ask, why would that be? Well, I don't think we're going to get any further answer, frankly.
Well,
but if we go to the very next frame, the I-90, we'll see that a FOIA request came back from the U.S. Coast Guard. Now, we know there were multiple Coast Guard vehicles, and they're arrayed there on the lower part. C-130 aircraft, that was the commander's aircraft, two Dolphin helicopters were also on scene. We had swimmers in the water. We had pilot and co-pilot and medical personnel. So we know in many ways, and we have actually a previous FOIA request where it literally says in that under orange or yellow underline, it describes which vehicles, which piloted vehicles were on scene for that particular incident. And it's just mind-boggling that later the FOIA came back from the U.S. Coast Guard saying, as it does in red in the second excerpted area in white, we are unable to locate or identify any responsive records. And we had asked for all U.S. government, Navy, to include Hawaii state government, federal government, or government contracted vehicles and piloted craft within 200 miles. And they said there were none. So that's just mind-boggling and amazing.
My goodness. Folks, I mean, here's Rex and his colleague doing the work of doing the investigative work that, well, this is explosive in terms of evidence, the weight of evidence, and the accumulate, the aggregate effect that this is having. Okay. All right.
You would hope the media would be doing investigative journalism.
Yeah.
But anyway, I-35, if you could go there, it says Salver, Sea Engineering's President Pat Ross, telling us that indeed the craft was 200 to 300 yards offshore and in water that was said to be 65 to 70 feet. But we also have the NTSB had two representatives on board, apparently, saying that the craft was lifted from about 50 feet of water. So there's a little discrepancy there. There's also the representation by the president there saying that the craft was found in a 100-foot debris field. Now, the airplane's dimensions, roughly width and lengthwise, are each about 50 feet. So this aircraft only moved within twice its distance, twice its horizontal or whatever. So it didn't really move over a great distance. Sometimes we read of crashes being found on the ocean floor spread over thousands of feet or even miles, kilometer, and so forth. But this was only a 100-foot debris field. But the pilot says something very curious. He says he found the craft on the ocean floor. And on the ocean floor, the wings were found separate. The fuselage was separate. The engines were separate. And he begins to stutter from rolling on the rocks in the swell. Maybe we can pull that up as an audio since it's so relevant and important. Are you able to do that?
We're gonna try to do that. Also regather our visual assets here as well.
Okay.
Hold on, Rex. Wow.
We're talking with Rex about the Loretta Fuddy plane crash. More with him right after this. Stay with us.
Paying close attention to this, Loretta Fuddy taken out or allegedly dying in a plane crash December 11th, 2013, is so much evidence to the contrary, so much evidence that this incident was staged. And when I say evidence, I'm talking about Rex and his colleague going through painstakingly, and I mean painstakingly going through, spending countless hours going through the video that was captured, the filing Freedom of Information Act requests, looking at that, looking at all of the reports. I have got a notebook full of hard copies that I got, a year and a half ago. This, that folks, you helped to get. And all of this is the evidence that's suggesting, no, none of this happened the way we were told. Now, that's obviously that shouldn't surprise anybody, but here's the big deal to this. You know, there are many claims. For example, Hillary's got a body double, and look at this, look at the video, and Hillary's this or that, or pick an incident that took place, and there are claims behind the incident. Now we've got Rex and his colleague who have done this remarkable investigation. The investigative work product is absolutely solid, in my view, to show that there are discrepancies, not just discrepancies, but the information that is not consistent with the factual accounting of, or at least their facts as to what happened. We're going to be getting back to Rex here momentarily. How are you sleeping at night? Let me ask you, do you sleep well? I know the Hagman family does, as does Lady the Studio Dog. I want to tell you about Casper Mattress, casper.com/CFP radio. That's casper.com/CFP radio. Or just go to Hagman and Hagman.com and click on the Casper link to the Casper Mattress. Casper is a sleep brand that created one perfect mattress sold directly to consumers. They eliminate the commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep surface was developed in-house. The mattress has got a beautiful, sleek design and is delivered in a small, how did they do that, sized box. In addition to the mattress, Casper, folks, they've got adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. And I'm so excited to let you know, they also have doggy beds. Oh, you've got to go to casper.com/CFP radio to take a look at the doggy beds that they've got. That's on Lady's Christmas wish list. Lady the Studio Dog is on her Christmas wish list. She wrote it down. Yeah. The mattress industry has forced consumers to pay notoriously high markups, folks. Casper is revolutionizing the mass mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to you and me. It's great. The quality is unsurpassed. They've got an in-house team of engineers who spent thousands of hours developing the Casper. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foam for a sleep surface that's got just the right sink, just the right bounce. It's breathable. The breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. And the one of the best things about it, mattresses, we know, can cost well over $1,500, but Casper mattresses cost $500 for a twin size, up to $950 for a king. You try to buy one of those at a reseller or showroom. No. Buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. They offer free delivery, free returns with a 100-night home trial. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a 30-year life on it. Folks, Casper, the Casper mattress is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It combines springy latex and supportive foams to create this award-winning sleep surface. Just the right sink, just the right bounce. Did you know Time Magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015? It's an award-winning mattress that won't disappoint. Free shipping and returns to U.S. and Canada. Folks, try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. It's made in America. It's fantastic. Made in America. Casper.com/CFP Radio. That's Casper.com/CFP Radio. By the way, special listeners to our show, you get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/CFP Radio and using CFP Radio in the section where it asks for a promo code. Remember that, $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/CFP Radio and inserting CFP Radio in the promo code section, coupon code section. You can also get the Casper mattress by going to Hagman and Hagman.com or HagmanReport.com and clicking the link to a Casper. And by the way, check out their dog beds. Oh my goodness. Lady's going to be so happy. Let's get back to Rex, the aviation computer expert. We're talking about the crash in quotation marks of Loretta Fuddy.
Yeah, and Rex's investigative finding after 3 years and countless hours building this investigation with fantastic visuals. If you go to our YouTube page, and you can watch the YouTube page and follow along while you listen on Global Star, just listen on YouTube as well, but you can get all the images through watching our YouTube feed. Let's pick up where we left off, Rex.
Okay. We were just listening to the president of that sour company, and he had mentioned stutteringly that the engines were separate, which is a really unusual thing to say. We were talking earlier about Hillary's body double. We saw that in the scenario, we have very clear proof that Loretta Fuddy was exchanged with a tall, skinny diver. You might for a moment say that was a body double, but very surprisingly, here we have an example of an engine having a body double. So that's really quite something. If we go to image, are you able to play audio 19?
We cannot do it at this point.
Okay.
And I apologize.
It's no big thing. We'll come to that later and have it available for everybody. But if we go to image 36, we have an image of the real number, numeric serial number appropriate to that airplane. That is, this is the engine that was registered with that airplane. However, if we see those yellow arrows, that's where the nose gear strut would be attached. And we have underwater imagery of the airplane after it hit the water, and it would have hit the water at 80 to 90 knots. That's really fast. And we have imagery to show that the nose gear strut was not even bent. It was on there to stay. However, the claim claim is that the airplane rolled around on the rocks, uneven rocks on the ocean floor, and somehow lost its nose gear. In not only lost it, but lost it so cleanly that you don't even have the bolts there anymore to be seen. You don't see breakage, you don't see bending, nothing. That's very clean. And even the worst storm underwater, maybe 10, 20, 20 knots of wave action. But this is a nose gear strut that just survived 80 knots of hitting the water. That's like a brick wall. It's another red flag for us aviation types, let me tell you. But if we move on to the next slide, this is what the salver brought up onto his barge. It appears to be about four seats, a wing, a third of the fuselage, not much else identifiable. You do see a landing gear there, and somewhere we're going to see that engine again, but it doesn't appear to be very much of the airplane. But we'll talk more about that later.
Yeah. Rex, from the aircraft being in relatively one piece to this, what'd they do? I mean, detonate something? I mean, I'm looking at this and it just doesn't comport.
Well, yes. The official story is that uneven rocks on the bottom of the ocean floor somehow took this aircraft and its engine apart.
Looks like somebody pulled through a blender.
I'd say with all of the hoax characteristics we have, we know there's a lot of lying going on, frankly. We'll get to that here momentarily. If we move on to image 39, we'll see, again, the words of the salver president up there. But looking at another way at that engine, in those green boxes and the green arrows, we see something that uneven rocks on the ocean floor just do not have or are not able to make, and that is straight-line saw cuts. All of those pieces are the engine mount strut members and other hoses, cables. Those were cut by some kind of saw. They weren't mangled by some uneven rocks on the ocean floor. And this is not just one piece. This is, I counted maybe 20 or more. And that just doesn't happen by the ocean floor's wave action, let me tell you. And somehow, the FAA report didn't pick up on that. They claim it was consistent with being completely repeatedly rolled over on a hard, uneven surface by wave action.
Those are pretty
and I find
cuts.
That completely unbelievable. The yep. evidence shows completely otherwise. And we have that evidence of the spewing bubbles at just the area of the engine mating with the firewall there. And it would take a very powerful little saw, probably a pneumatic saw, which would account for bubbles to cut those kind of things. And we know a very favorite saw, I'll advertise here for a moment, Rodec saws can do this, and they do this all the time. It's a favorite implement of aviation types to do this very thing. Now, maybe it was another brand, but I plugged them, I guess. But the long and the short is, you need a saw to do that. You cannot claim, as these people audaciously do, that somehow the ocean floor, even in a storm of 10 to 20 knot wave action, somehow did this. It's just astounding, audacious, outrageous, and all of that. So we're on to something here that is, when people lie to cover up things, they'll lie more than once. But anyway, let's move on. If we look to image 40, the next one, this is another several images of the engine from different angles. The NTSB image at far left, the big one, shows all the propeller blades. Now, even though the engine obviously received many blows that pound on the surfaces there, you'll see, the propeller is relatively unscathed, and it has some light, gentle bends on the blades, the two left and right, which I've called the 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock, and then there's a 12 o'clock up top. if you look at the upper right image, that 12 o'clock blade is just slightly bent, a little bit like a hockey stick on the upper right. But in the NTSB's image, we don't see any of the blade tip paint. And that's unfortunate because that would be relevant. And yet, there's only one image that the NTSB put in its report that shows that propeller tip paint. Anyway, we see it in another image of another media outlet. Plug them for a moment, Hawaii News Now, thank you very much. In the lower right, we see the blade tip paint scheme. And it's got a nice little wide black area between two white areas. But if we move on to the next image, we're going to see firstly the same image on the left from the NTSB, and then also from the NTSB, an image underwater. And as I said, the nose gear strut is seemingly undisturbed. And we see two of the three propeller blades there. The third one is apparently just coincidentally on the far side of the engine. And we see the lowest blade is apparently contacted the water first, has the most force before things started to slow down. And the upper blade there that we see probably endured a lot less water force because it's not bent. So, but that lower blade is clearly bent backward. It appears to be in contact with the left side of the strut, and that's very relevant. But the question would be, if you look at the NTSB image, which of those blades would have been that severely bent backward blade that we see underwater? The answer is none of them.
No.
And a blade, a propeller blade, does not become unbent. I mean, the wave action does not know how to unbend a propeller.
All right. I mean, there it is. There's... All right. Obviously, somebody's lying here. Okay.
Yeah. Well, this left engine with its less bent propellers, and frankly, I mean, it just can't be the same engine. But that engine was sent off to the engine manufacturer, and they were told that that was the one that ditched. And it was found to have all kinds of problems inside and intense internal fire. It had fractured compressor turbine blades. It had impact on the turbine shroud. It had a third to four-fifths of the blades all mangled and eaten away, or debris had wrecked them. They had broken off. That was obviously an engine that had a catastrophic engine failure. But it is not the one that sounded so wonderfully all the way down to the water in the video that we have seen and heard. So it's just not the same engine. So there's a lot of evidence to support this. And we'll be looking at that momentarily. Let's
so
move
someone
on to
swapped
the very
out
next.
The engine. All right. Go ahead.
Yep.
Next one. All right.
The next one shows that the propeller blade tape tip paint scheme. That is, we collected several underwater frames of the blade tip paint scheme and placed them aside the one that we have on the barge that we saw in the image just a few slides ago, and compared how that blade tip paint scheme looked between the barge images and the ones underwater. And none of the ones underwater seem to have that nice, big, wide space. So the evidence very strongly seems to suggest, as well as that bend that we saw just a moment ago, that this was a different propeller that was underwater on the ditched engine versus the one that the NTSB would show and make pictures of on the Salvers barge. So the evidence is very strong about that. But there's more. If we go to the next image, we see an image from the NTSB report, and it has the only blade tip paint scheme that is in this entire report. And we see that just below the orange box, just to the lower right thereof, between the big tire and the gentleman standing to the right. And that blade tip doesn't seem to match the one that we had elsewhere. And if we look at the engine above that tire, for example, and it's expanded to the right, it's all fuzzed up. It seems like it's a double exposure. And yet if you look at other places in the image on the left, say, for example, in the red light at the upper left of that image, or the blue shirt of the gentleman to the right, or the stair step, the block and tackle shadow that we see, none of that has a double exposure. But that area where the engine is does, and that gentleman to the lower left of the engine also has a very unique double exposure of his body and shoulder, you see. So you have to ask, what in the world is going on there? And why, this is the only image of the back of the engine in that NTSB report, why would it be that that we have a double exposure? So moving on, if we take that book author we spoke about, he has an image, also says courtesy of the NTSB, he has a very fine image of the rear part of the engine. He's placed it in his book. It's there to the right. And in that image, we see copious saw cuts, just like the other image we had from another source. And I've identified, eight or ten of those. But if we move then to the next image, we see an image that we had from before at the lower middle versus the one on this author-provided image that also came from the NTSB. That is two hoses, two cables, two places where the metal has been sawed. And we see both inlets there, both sawed. But in the image on the upper right, one is covering the other. And if we compare those two images, they're not covering each other the same way. And these are kind of heavier metal pipes. They don't just flop into place. They had to be moved into place. So somebody apparently on site had to see that, well, they could at least eliminate the view of one of those saw cuts and obscure that. So there's a little bit of culpability perhaps in that. If we move to the next image, image 46, we've taken the image that was provided by the same frame from the NTSB that had the double exposure engine. We've taken that propeller blade tip paint scheme. We've rotated it and compared it to all the underwater blade tip paint schemes. And I'd have to say, there's a very close match to that. Those look pretty comparable. So maybe we have to do a double take and think about that rather than the evidence we thought was pretty clear just a few slides ago. Maybe we have to go back to the drawing board. But if we go to the next frame, image 47, you'll see, firstly, in the upper left, that same image that we used first for the underwater blade comparison. And then on the right, the NTSB-provided blade. But if you just look back and forth at them, you say, they're not the same. But an aviation person knows that all modern propellers on the same blade have the same blade tip paint scheme. That's just a well-known fact. That's just not found any other way. And that's an anomaly that's really strong here. But these two are clearly not the same, so what do we do about that? Well, we go to the next image and take a look. This is a close-up of that image, as can be seen in the lower left in the box that expands. There's a notch drawn to by the red arrow at the bottom of that propeller blade, and you can see on the far side of that notch there's a heavy metal pipe from the ship. However, if we look at the NTSB's relative portion of that very same blade, that is the backside that we saw earlier in a couple of images, we have to say there's no notch there. It's written there, no notch here, in red. But how can that possibly be? That is, that's the very same blade. We know. It's the same wreckage. Why doesn't it exhibit the same notch? If we go to the next image, image 49, those yellow arrows point to what we call jaggies. Jaggies occur in digital images. There's just no way around it. And at a certain resolution, you see certain characteristics of the jaggies. And those jaggies are fairly characteristic at the tips of the yellow arrows. However, if you look at the NTSB's provided blade tip paint scheme there, you see the two red arrows pointing at jaggies that are kind of coarse. They're not quite the same as those other jaggies elsewhere. So that's really unusual. But that's the kind of thing that if you had a lower resolution image and you borrowed a portion of that image and put it in an image of a different resolution, that's the very kind of thing that you might have as a residual effect of that. If we look
so
at
the images
50,
were doctored. I mean, I'll say it. If as a layperson, the images appear doctored, right?
You think that you're convinced? We have even more evidence, but you could say the bottom line. Look at image 40-50.
All right.
And we see that 4 o'clock blade tip paint scheme versus what the NTSB has provided. Now, you'd have to say that's got to have been doctored. But if we move ahead, two images there, I-52, we have other images from other sources. Other people had cameras other than the NTSB. And we've got pictures of that very same blade tip, the very one. And we see those on the upper right and lower middle. And they exhibit a different paint scheme. There is no way in the world that anything else happened other than that somebody who was caring for this NTSB image doctored it, photoshopped it, changed it, because it originally looked like the other two. And it wasn't done at that moment. Somebody had a paintbrush and swapped it. We know from that very hour, or those hours where this was available for inspection, that the blade tip paint scheme was different. And yet the NTSB chose to provide that image on the left. And you'd have to say, the only possible reason that could be that someone would also alter, falsify evidence in a multi-year, two and a half calendar year, how many man year, conjecture of 10, 15, 20 man year. Who would do that? Who would make a criminal act to falsify evidence? Who would risk their life and career to do that?
Who indeed? Rex, stay right where you're at. Folks, stay right where you're at. This is absolutely amazing. You want evidence, hard evidence? Here it is. Who's going to take it and run with it? Anyone? Anyone? You're listening to Hagman and Hagman. Exclusive. Be right back.